أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. أما بعد، قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتابه الكريم، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: إن فرعون علا في الأرض وجعل أهلها شيعة يستضعف طائفة منهم يذبح أبناءهم ويستحيي نساءهم إنه كان من المفسدين. ونريد أن نمن على الذين استضعفوا في الأرض ونجعلهم أئمة ونجعلهم الوارثين ونمكن لهم في الأرض ونري فرعون وهامان وجنودهما منهم ما كانوا يحضرون. صلوات.
اللهم صل على
محمد. Today it's going to be our final session, and before I continue, I just want to thank Allah for giving this small student the tawfiq to be able to serve the believers, and inshallah to be able to provide some sort of account of the events of Ashura that were pleasing inshallah to Fatima Zahra, to Rasulullah, to Imam Mahdi, inshallah ta'ala, for Rajab al-Sharif. So one of the things that I'd like to do today is to complete our discussion that we've had over the last 4 days. And if you remember, we've been discussing certain vices of the soul, certain vices that affect us in our everyday lives, and that also have an impact on what's happening around us, what's happening in the society that we live in. And we've discussed at some length, although not enough, the whole concept of secularization of our societies, and these various vices of asabiyya, of tribalism, nationalism, discrimination, of kibar, of ujub, of riya, all of these vices that affect us. Sometimes they affect us in a way we don't realize they're affecting us. We also mentioned an ayah of Quran which I want to just work a little bit more on with you, if I may, and that is the ayah regarding the expulsion of shaitan, how he became a kafir. Because this is something which is a very, very important lesson for us. This is something I can't emphasize enough. We as Muslims, as lovers of Imam Ali, as followers of Imam Mahdi Jalla Ta'ala Faraj al-Sharif, we have to be that much more careful. Because we follow those people who are an example to all of humanity. As a result, we have to be examples as well for humanity. If we ever examine the word Shia, this word Shia, in Arabic it means partisan of, means follower of. It's not something I can confer upon myself. I can't, as Shabir, turn around and say, I am a Shia of Imam Mahdi. I can't do that, I'd be lying. I would be lying. I can say I want to aspire to be a Shia of Imam Mahdi. I am a lover of Imam Mahdi. But only Imam Mahdi can tell me if I'm a Shia or not. This is important for us to understand. Of course, there's of course the understanding of the Shia as a grouping. I'm not saying that we say that, no, we are just like this, we're Muslims. No, we're Shia. But what our own understanding of it should be that, am I worthy to be called a Shia? Has my Imam been pleased with my actions? Every day we have the famous hadith of Amir al-Mu'mineen where he says, make an account of yourself before you are accounted for. Make an account for everything you do before you get accounted for. And we are told in the books of Akhlaq that we should, every night before we go to sleep, reflect on what we've done in the last day. Sit down and reflect. And if that day has had fewer sins than the one before, alhamdulillah. And we should pray to Allah to give us tawfiq to reduce the sins even more. And if the day has been a bad day, then we should make istighfar, and we should cry to Allah, that Allah, please give me tawfiq not to make these gunah. Now, these ideas of kibar, of arrogance, of pride, of tribalism, of discrimination, these are things, sometimes they happen in us without us realizing it. Sometimes, let's say for example, a young guy is in a school. You have a young child in a school, he's in the playground, he sees some new guy coming in. This new guy, na'uzubillah, he's in a wheelchair, or he's wears glasses, or he's got some deficiency, quote deficiency. And sometimes they might treat him different. Sometimes they might make fun of him. Sometimes they might look down on him. This is a form of asabiyya. This is a form of kibar. This is a form of I'm better than someone. Because at the end of the day, we as people, we as Muslims, we are all subordinates to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We are all accountable to Him, every single one of us. Be that person fat or thin, be that person black or white, be that person disabled or enabled. All of us are accountable to Allah. None of us know where we're going to go on that next day. None of us know what will happen to us. None of us know what will be our fate. The only thing we can do is live in hope and do the right thing, act according to the teachings, and we as followers of Ahlul Bayt, we are blessed. Wallahi, we are so blessed, we don't realize this ni'mah. We don't realize this ni'mah that our mothers have given us. We don't realize this ni'mah that our fathers have given us. Because this is something you can't go into the shop and buy. The brothers and sisters that come into Islam from the outside, for them, they are blessed. Because their parents must have done something right. That nasl, that pureness, has to come from somewhere. If your heart doesn't have purity in it, if your heart doesn't have ikhlas, then how can you love that person who is the complete mukhlis? How can you come close to that person who is the complete mukhlis? You can't. Salawat. Now one more thing to move on just a little bit. One other problem that is created by these crimes of asabiyya, kibar, ujub, is something called shirk. All of us know what shirk is. Shirk, the common definition, is making a partner for Allah. Now through our discussions over the last few days, we've discussed and we've come to the conclusion that when we are arrogant, or when Shaitan was arrogant, he almost made himself appear with Allah. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said many, many times that the one crime he will never forgive is shirk. He will forgive everything. He is Ghafoor Rahim. He will forgive everything. But the one thing he will not forgive is shirk. Why? We have to think, why is this? What is special about this crime of shirk? Of course, there is a superficial understanding. Of course, there is only one Allah, yes. But the bigger reasons, and this is some of the ulama of akhlaq and the ulama of adab, they say this, they discuss this. Shirk is something where you are oppressing Allah. Now this requires some thinking. How can we oppress Allah? How can we make dhulm to Allah? Allah is everything. Who are we? What can we do to Him? When we say that there's more than, na'uzubillah, when we say there's more than one Allah, does Allah change? No. If we make namaz, does Allah become more? No. If we don't do namaz, does Allah become less? No, He doesn't. Allah is pure, He's constant. So how are we doing dhulm from Him? Dhulm is of multiple types. Dhulm is of so many different types. Sometimes you might do something to someone. For example, have you ever been in a situation where you've been sitting down, you've been discussing with some friends, and you've said something you don't realize it's upset one person in your group? You've said something about something. You don't know what it is necessarily, but you haven't been thoughtful. And one person in your group, he goes on with a heavy heart. You don't know, he doesn't even tell you anything. But you have oppressed him. You have done something to him which is bad, which is negative. When we do shirk, we oppress ourselves. As a result, we oppress Allah. The oppression on Allah is not direct, of course. But we oppress ourselves because we pull ourselves away from Allah. When we make shirk of any type, and what is shirk? When we become arrogant, it's a form of shirk. We have a hadith to this effect. But remember, there are minor forms of shirk and major forms of shirk. The Christians, the people who call themselves Christians of nowadays, they perform something which is a major form of shirk. Major form of shirk is when you say Allah has a son, or Allah is three, or whatever. A minor form of shirk is when you say Allah is one, but you act in a way as if you are also Allah. You act in a way that you are also Allah. But also, shirk of a minor form is when you act in a way where Allah doesn't exist. Allah is one, but not the numeric one. Because the numeric one is deficient. How? The numeric one preceding it is zero. Following it is two. Therefore, to say Allah is numeric one is to insult Allah. Allah is unique. He is unique. وَلَمْ يَكُلْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٍ. The translation of this is that He is unique. He is completely unique. There is nothing like Him. There is nothing that can be compared to Him. So when we try and become like Him, even though we're not actively doing it, this is where we have to be careful. Even though we're not saying that I believe in more than one Allah, or I believe in two Allahs. No. Even when we don't say it, if we act in a fashion where we're not accountable to Him, we've relegated Allah to zero. Because if we're not accountable to Him, who are we accountable to? We're not accountable to anyone. Salawat. The same way that there is minor and major forms of shirk, there are major and minor forms of kufr as well. And this is also important. I know I'm rushing through this a little bit. Unfortunately, I have very little time with you collectively. And I'm trying to cover a subject which is, it can't be covered in years and years and years. So if you're still interested, give me a last salawat. There are major and minor forms of kufr. And this makes you think. Sometimes, when we're walking in the street, we do something, we actually, for a split second, become kafir. I'm sure, obviously we don't, I'm just using the example, right? Sometimes when people are walking in the street, they might have just come back from a namaz. They might have come back from a Husayniyah, but they get out in the street, they do something, and for that second they become kafir. How? When we lie, when we say something which is not true, what are we doing? We are only fooling ourselves. We are covering up the truth for ourselves. To the person we're talking to, it doesn't matter. They're taking our information. Okay, fine, they take our information. That's another discussion for what happens if they follow that information. But in reality, it's benign for them. The person who is suffering is me. Because I know, for example, my tasbih is black and white. If I turn around and I tell you my tasbih is blue, you guys will think I'm from another planet. You might think I'm colorblind. Really, doesn't make that much of a difference to you. But to me, I know I've been a fool. I know I've done something wrong. I know I've done something where I've covered the truth. Because if there's one person in this room who doesn't know what the colors black and red look like, from that point onwards, this person will think the color blue is actually the colors black and red. So I will have given that person misinformation. That's one side of it. On the other side, I've covered up something which I know to be the truth. For example, I'll give you an example I'm sure everyone will understand. If we take the example after the death of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. When there were certain people who gathered in that place of Saqifa, each one of those people knew what Rasulullah had said about Imam Ali. Some of them had gone to Amir al-Mu'mineen and said, Bakhin, Bakhin, Ya Abu al-Hasan. They said, congratulations, congratulations, O Abu al-Hasan. They knew exactly what the situation was. They knew that Ali ibn Abi Talib was the wali of Allah, was the successor of the Prophet. And for that moment when they instigated, they lied, and in lying didn't reduce Imam Ali in any way.
No.
Imam Ali is an imam. Whether he has the seat of temporal power or he doesn't. Did people like Ammar and Malik Ashtar, Miqdad, Salman, Abu Dharr, did they reject Imam Ali because he didn't have that power? Of course not. Some of the fools did, of course, we know. But these were the people that were pushing for this in the first place. But the companions, the real companions, the mukhlisin, the people who were sincere, they didn't reject it. And Imam Ali for them was the point of reference, whether he was the Khalif or whether he was inside the garden digging. Whatever Ali was doing, he was the Imam, full stop, khalas. There is no one else except Ali who is the Imam now, finished. So the people in Saqifa, what did they do? They fooled themselves. That's the only thing they did. Yes, it created an effect, a ripple effect, the results of which we can see now. The results of which was the death of Fatima Zahra, salamullah alayha. The result of which was the piercing of arrows of the coffin of Hassan. The result of which was Karbala and so on. There was the result of what their actions were, but in reality the only people they fooled was themselves. Because the truth remained. Even though Fatima Zahra was murdered, even though Imam Hassan was refused to be buried in the house of the Prophet, even though Imam Hussein was killed in Karbala, even though the women and Imam Sajjad and the families were taken in chains to Kufa and then to Sham, even through all of this, the true Islam of Muhammad remained. The truth remained. Why? Because Allah has promised He's going to protect it. Allah has said, I am protecting this myself. This is my responsibility to protect. So when they lied, there was no effect as such to the truth. The truth was pure. The people that were fooled were themselves because they began to believe their rhetoric. In fact, there's a funny story of the first Khalif. I can't confirm or deny whether it's completely authentic, but it's nice to share it sometimes. And I'm sure many of you will have heard it. His father apparently went to him and said to him, my son, how did you become the Khalif of the Muslims? So he looks at his father and he says, well, you know, I have the whitest beard. I am the most senior person. I'm paraphrasing. I am the most senior person in this regard. So his father scratches his beard, scratches his head and says, I'm a Muslim, huh? He said, yep. And you're the most senior person. That's why you became the Khalif. That's right. I'm your dad. I'm senior to you. Even his father knew what the truth was. It didn't fool even his father. No one was fooled by these people except those people who wanted to be fooled, who had problems with their ikhlas. Why? And there's proof in Quran for this. How? The proof in Quran is this. In Quran, when talking about shaitan, when discussing his fall, there's a dialogue that happens between shaitan and Allah. Shaitan says to Allah, I haven't got the ayah, so I'm going to paraphrase. Shaitan says to Allah, that you please give me muhlat, please give me a facility until the last day, because of all the worships and everything I've done for you. So Allah says, you're amongst those who've been given that permission until the promised day. Then He says that I will misguide each and every one of them. إِلَّا عِبَادِ اللَّهِ الْمُخْلَصِينَ. Except those who are... Shaitan is saying, not Allah. Shaitan is saying, I will misguide all of them except those who are sincere. Except those who are مِنَ الْمُخْلَصِينَ. The sincere ones. And Allah repeats and says, yes, you will not be able to misguide those who are among the mukhlasin. Now who are these mukhlasin? We have one surah in Quran, we mentioned it briefly yesterday. It's about Tawheed, but it's also called Surah Al-Ikhlas. And it's the most pure definition of Allah's Tawheed. It covers every side. Surah Al-Ikhlas has got some of the most amazing tafaseer on it. We could do a whole year of majalis just on Surah Al-Ikhlas. We could do a discussion for over a year just on Surah Al-Ikhlas and only touch the surface. Even though it's a very small surah. But it's talking about Allah. And in this surah, every avenue to make shirk, every possible gate to shirk is locked, closed, and the key is thrown away. If we stick to this surah Ikhlas, then we will have that Ikhlas. Why? وَلَمْ يَكُلْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٍ. There is nothing and no one like him. If we keep that in our minds all the time, that there is no one, there is nothing that is like Allah, Allah is unique, then never will a situation come where we become arrogant and try and connect ourselves to Allah. Even subconsciously, because Allah is in our mind all the time and in our heart. We'll never be vicious to anyone because we know we have to answer to that. We'll never say a lie because we know that that is something Allah knows that we'll be lying. We won't do any of these vices if only we could understand Surah Ikhlas. It is called Surah Ikhlas because once you understand it, once you memorize it, once you have it inside your heart, it develops that Ikhlas, that khulus, that sincerity. Sincerity even is not the right word, but English is a weak language. It's the best word that I can come out with in English. Sincerity is not enough, but khair, you'll have that ikhlas over time. And once you have that ikhlas, it will protect you, it will act like a shield. Because those people in Karbala, those people who were with Imam Ali, in Jalal, in Nahrawan, in Siffin, the ones who stayed on his side, like Ammar, like Malik, like all of these people, they stayed with Ali, no questions, no nothing. Someone could try and kill them. Ammar was told that you will be killed by the oppressors. We heard Mawlana say it. Ammar was told he would be killed by the oppressors. In the battle, he knew he was going to be killed. What did he do? Did he run away like some of the others?
No.
He stayed, he stood his ground, and he fought. But leave Ammar. Ammar wasn't hungry and thirsty for 3 days. If we look in Karbala, you look at all of these companions, all of them. They weren't many. But those, each and every one of them, each and every one of them, and unfortunately we don't discuss the companions. We should sometimes maybe have extra sessions to discuss the companions. Although I understand it's difficult. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
If we look at the companions of Imam Hussein, if we look at someone like Habib. Look at someone like Habib ibn Madar. He wasn't young. He was an old man. He was old. He'd been through a lot. He'd seen a lot. But did he run away? You know, some people might say that he was old, you know, he was going to die soon anyway, so he didn't have any reason to run away. It's possible people might say that. Some people are ignorant. If we look at some of the other companions, there were youngsters amongst them. There were youth. We talk about the youth of Bani Hashim, yes. But there were the youth of Bani Asad as well. There were the youth of the Azdi tribe, and many, many other groups that were supporting Imam Hussein. These youth were in the prime of their lives. Some of them were not even married. Some of them were young. Some of them, according to some riwayat, some of them were engaged. They were betrothed. They were going to go back to their families. Well, this was the idea. But when their imam said that I am getting up to reform the ummah of my grandfather, no one of them asked a single question. They just said, okay, my imam, you've made the command, let's go. You point me in the direction I'm off. This is what ikhlas gives you. Ikhlas gives you trust in your leadership. If you look at any nizam, any system, one of the most important things is you listen to your general, your leader's command. I'll give you an example of Hezbollah in Lebanon. And just giving the example doesn't make me a terrorist, in case someone thinks that. And if it does, alhamdulillah, family. Now, Hezbollah in Lebanon, if you look at this, if you look at the people, the young soldiers, and I call them soldiers, because not one of them calls himself anything else. They are soldiers. There have been situations where there's been, in 2006, when the Israelis decided to get smart and try and do something. In 2006, some soldiers, they were sitting at home reading books. Some were in the houses, some were in books, some were playing on computers. And one of my friends asked them, that, man, how come you aren't out in the battlefield? He says, no, we haven't been given a command. We've been told to stay over here, that's our command, so we're staying over here. Yeah, but the Israelis are bombing, they're doing this, they're doing this. We haven't been given the command to go, so we're not going to think ahead. It's not our place to think ahead, because our leader knows what's going on. When our leader gives the command, we follow. Right now my leader has said, you sit. So I sit. That is my duty. When my leader says, stand and fight, I'll go and fight. This is that Karbala'i mentality. And because of this mentality, if we look through the entire modern day civilization, never in history, and even the Israeli sages, never in history has this Israeli war machine been defeated. Never. The Egyptians, the Syrians, the Jordanians, I don't know, all of these big armies, these big Arab, and I use the word Arab, not Arab. Arab is desert Arab, it's different. All of these people, they had huge armies and weapons and tanks and this and that. And they couldn't fight even the fledgling Israeli army. In 6 days they were wiped out. But when you have people who follow the kirdar of Ali ibn Abi Talib, when you have people who follow and are loyal to Imam Mahdi, when you have people who are loyal and follow the command of their wali faqih, when you have people who are loyal and follow the command of the naib of their wali faqih, of their marja, without question, without saying, oh, but I don't like this. No. Even if they don't like it. When you have people like this, in 33 days, the most powerful military machine in the Middle East puts its tail between its legs and runs. And I'll give you a couple of stories from Israeli soldiers. These are stories from Israeli soldiers about what they saw in the battlefield. They have said, and they are on the record, you can find these. They have said that on the battlefield in South Lebanon, they saw a sword, a two-pronged sword, without a hand, made of light, and it would come to them. And many of them were killed with it. I'm not making this up, this is real. Not from our own people, from the Israelis. They said they saw angels, beings of light, come towards them. When they went after these groups of the Hezbollah soldiers, they couldn't see them. They could see the missiles, they couldn't see the soldiers. I'll give you one story. A friend of mine became shaheed in that time. His name was Bashir Alawiyyah. When he became shaheed, no one knew he was a soldier. His family, his mother didn't know he was a soldier. He used to work with a friend of mine in making graphics and things like this. He became shaheed. He was given the command to go at night. He went at night, he became shaheed. A couple of weeks later, he came in a dream of one brother who is very close to me in Lebanon. And he told Hadi, he said to Hadi, Hadi was upset because they used to work together. He said to Hadi that, look, first of all, my apologies, I'm not going to be able to finish this project with you. Secondly, I want you to give a message to a fellow called Ahmed. There's a surname, but it's not necessary to mention. Give a message to this person called Ahmed that he will be joining us. This person, Ahmed, used to live very close to Hadi. Hadi went at night, around Fajr time, went across the road to this fellow's house, told him, found that he's not at home. He's been sent to the battlefield. That morning, around Dhuhr time, they found out he'd become shaheed. Now this is out of ikhlas. When you can do this, when you have that much belief, we sometimes, living maybe in the West or even elsewhere, sometimes we begin to doubt, especially since the Ghaybat al-Kubra has been quite long. We begin to doubt all of these miracles. We begin to doubt that, is this real? But this is why Imam Khomeini, Qudus sirruh, said, إِنَّ جِحَادَ حِزْبُ اللَّهِ فِي لُبْنَانِ حُجَّةٌ لِلْعُلَمَاءِ. The jihad of Hezbollah in Lebanon is a proof, is a hujjah. He could have said it's an example. He could have used many words. Why did he use the word hujjah? What is it a proof for? It is a proof for the fact that if you are mukhlaseen, if you are sincere, then no matter how much they hit you, if they take Sheikh Raghib, no problem. If they take Sayyid Abbas, no problem. If they take Imad Mughniyah, no problem. If they kill thousands of us, no problem. If they flatten us, no problem. Because Allah has said in Quran, He is the one who has revealed the book, and He will make it prevail whatever they say. And if you trust in that, then nothing can break you, nothing can defeat you, nothing. Salawat. And this is our task. This is what we have to do. Many people think that in Lebanon, Hezbollah, the main thing they do is carry guns around and kill people. This is maybe 1% of what is Hezbollah. Maybe 0.5% even. The majority of what is Hezbollah is what? Is what we're doing now. Is discussing Islamic ideas. Is helping those people who need help. If we see someone is in problems, instead of ignoring it, we go and help them. We go and sit with them. We say, okay, my brother, my sister, how can I help you? You have this problem. Ya Allah, let's come. Come together, we'll try and help you. We have to begin to build ourselves as a society. We have to look over all of these differences that we have. We have something in common, and that's Islam. That's Quran and Ahlul Bayt. And we have to bring ourselves together. Yes, we are different. Of course, we have different cultural backgrounds. But these are blessings. Sometimes when I'm sitting here, I don't understand Punjabi. But for me, it is a sharaf. It is an honor to be sitting when I hear a musiba in Punjabi. When I hear a noha or a manthiya in Punjabi or Urdu or something like this. I feel happy. Because it tells me something. It tells me that throughout this entire world with 7 billion people, in every single language, the name of Hussein is still high. In every language. And this tells me that when the head of Abu Abdullah was raised on that spear, and when Imam Sajjad saw it and he said, As-salamu alayka ya Abu Abdullah, that salam of my Imam Sajjad is still going. And it's going to go eternally. It will never stop. Salawat. So this is our task. And this is what we have to try and do. We have to fight all of these internal problems and these issues that we have within ourselves. We have to become examples for everyone. People from the outside should be looking at us and saying, I want to be like these people. These people are nice. These people are friendly, they're efficient, they're polite to be with, they seem organized, they seem good. The enemies should be terrified of us. The enemies, those who want to hurt us, they should be terrified. They should be shaking in their boots. The same way that Israel is shaking its boots about Hezbollah, there is no Sunni group, and I don't like bringing Sunni Shia into things, but there is even Hamas, which is doing good work. But Israel is not frightened of Hamas like it's frightened of Hezbollah. Even the US administration, when they were talking about Al-Qaeda, they still had to say that the A team of the terrorists is Hezbollah, the B team is Al-Qaeda. So Hezbollah is still technically the A team, even according to the enemies. This is how much they fear us. Now, I'm not going to get into a discussion about terrorism. That's a long subject. But it should be known that even a lot of Western thinkers have said that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. And according to some of the definitions or the understandings of today, Imam Hussein would be considered a terrorist. And if my Imam is a terrorist, it is something honorable for me to be called a terrorist. Of course, we know he wasn't. Because putting terror into the hearts of people is not something a lover of Hussein does. A lover of Hussein puts love into the hearts of others. And he infuses that love of Allah. We need to become like the companions of Hussein. Of course, the companions of Hussein are special. Imam Hussein himself has said that no Imam has had companions like me, nor will have companions like me. These are special people. But even though they're special, we should aspire to become like them. We mustn't take this attitude of, oh, we can never be like them, so why bother? No. We must always strive, because we don't know. If we are honored with the dhuhur of Imam Mahdi Jalla Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif, in our lifetime, or even if not in our lifetime, if we recite Dua Ahad, inshallah, we get raised. If we are honored to be in his service, then maybe we too will be able to be called the companions of the Imam. So we must try, we must work hard on ourselves. First on ourselves. That's the important thing. First on ourselves. But in parallel. Not, I only work on myself, khalas. No. We work in parallel. We work on ourselves, our family, our community, our friends. We work collectively, we have to multitask. And this will help us to become better, because if I want to tell someone not to lie, then I have to make sure I'm not lying. If I tell someone not to do something haram, I have to make sure I'm not doing it. If I tell someone they should wake up for Fajr, I should make sure I'm waking up for Fajr. I have to always fix myself in order to help others. So it's self-fulfilling. We have to try and become like Aun and Muhammad. Our youth should try and become like Aun and Muhammad. The older youth should try and become like Ali Akbar, who was the apple of his father's eye. They should become the apples of their father's eyes. They should be listening to their fathers, their mothers. They should be following their instructions. And if the father and mother are making a mistake, correct them the way Imam Hussein and Hassan corrected the old man in the masjid, like I discussed yesterday. But we must always retain that bond between our families. Nowadays in this world, the family is breaking. It's disintegrating. We must fight this. We must try and protect our families. Our families are very important. MashaAllah, many of you are Sadat. This is even more important because you come from that pure family. So we must really, really try and protect that family. Do whatever we can. And make ourselves more Islamic, make ourselves closer. Every year we mourn these champions of Kabbalah, every year we mourn them. We cry, we do matam. But we should remember that they gave everything for Allah, everything for Islam. In the ziyarat of the Shuhada of Kabbalah, we say, As-salamu alaykum ya ansar deen Allah. As-salamu alaykum ya ansar Rasulillah ila akhir. They are the helpers of the deen of Allah. They are the helpers of Rasulullah. They are the helpers of Lady Khadija. They are the helpers of Lady Fatima. The helpers of Imam Ali and so on. Don't we want to become people who are the helpers of Islam? Don't we want to become people who are, inshallah, the helpers of Imam Mahdi? Because if we're the helpers of Imam Mahdi, we also become the helpers of Rasulullah. We also become the helpers of Imam Ali. We become the helpers of Fatima Zahra, and so on. And this is the greatest sharaf that anyone can obtain, in this world and the next. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Now, I'd like you to cast your mind back to that plain of Karbala. And remember, it's close to the Asr of Ashura. All of the loyal companions have gone. All of the family members have gone. My master Abu Abdullah is alone. He stands alone. He comes towards the battlefield. And he makes a cry that resonates till today and forevermore. A cry that can't be silenced. A cry that will continue until it's responded by the grandson of Abu Abdullah. And on this note, especially in these days in the run-up to Ashura, we should remember our master Imam Mahdi Ajjalallah Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Because Imam Mahdi is the one who is waiting to come and take revenge for that innocent blood. He is the one waiting, his sword is in his sheath, and every time he wants to take it out. But he is waiting for us to be ready. And this is something we should weep about. We are delaying our Imam because we are not good enough. We are delaying our Imam because we are not good enough. Can you imagine delaying Imam Ali? Can you imagine delaying Rasulullah, delaying Imam Hussein? No. We have to work on ourselves to become those companions of Imam Al-Hujjah. Because otherwise, how can we turn around every Friday in Dua Nutbah and say, Ayna al-Talibu bidami al-Maqtooli bi Karbala? How can we say, where is the one who will come and avenge the blood of Karbala, when we are the ones who are delaying him? This is something we should be crying about, my brothers and sisters. We hear the cry of Imam Hussein on that plain of Karbala, and it resonates through time and through the battlefield. He says, Hal min nasir yansurni? Hal min mughithin yughithuni? Is there anyone who will assist me? Is there anyone who will help me? As Imam Hussein makes this call, Umm Rubab, the mother of Abdullah Radi, also known as Ali Asghar, shrieks for her child, a babe in arms, 6 months old. 6 months old, he is trying to push himself out of his cot. Ali Asghar fell from the cradle as he heard the cry of Abdullah. Imam Hussein was called, and he came, and he saw the thirst was gradually killing Ali Asghar. He asked permission of Umm Rubab to take him into the battlefield and to ask the enemies, maybe by seeing the child, their hearts might break, they might give him some water. He took Ali Asghar to the battlefield. He said, O people, if Hussein has wronged you, then don't give Hussein water. But tell me, what has this six-month-old child done to any of you? Ali Asghar also played his part. Don't think because he was 6 months old, he did nothing. Ali Asghar also played his part. As Imam Hussein was saying these words, Ali Asghar took his dry tongue and he rubbed it over his lips in a gesture that even the coldest of the enemy began to shake and began to become mournful. The army of Yazid was grieved, and some of them began questioning their belief in Yazid and his rule. Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, may Allah curse him, the commander of the army of Yazid, became nervous. He knew that if this was allowed to continue, there would be anarchy in his ranks, and the battle would be lost. This evil person, this son of Marjana, may Allah curse him, ordered this person, Hurmala, to kill the child, saying what? Ya Hurmala, iqta qalam al-Hussein. Cut the sermon of Hussein. Break the sermon of Hussein. He meant kill this child, Ali Asghar, who was acting as the voice of Hussein. Hussein, when he saw this, when he heard this, he put Ali Asghar on the ground, thinking maybe These people, if he's with me, they won't give a problem. The people began to get more upset. Ubaydullah said again, "Itta kalam al-Hussein." Imam Hussein picked Ali Asghar up. Now Hormala, he was one of the greatest archers. He shot an arrow that pierced the neck of Ali Asghar. But my brothers and sisters, what type of arrow was it? This is an infant of 6 months. A single pronged arrow, a normal arrow, would have been sufficient. But no. And may Lady Zahra reward your tears. Hormala used a trident, a three-pronged arrow that was used by the Arab hunters for hunting camels and elephants. Now can you imagine the fragile neck of Ali Asghar? And can you imagine the neck of an elephant or a camel? According to some riwayats, when it pierced the neck of Ali Asghar, and I don't know if you can bear this, when it pierced the neck of Ali Asghar, it killed him, but it was so heavy. And it was so large in comparison to this fragile body that not only did it embed itself in the arms of Hussein, who was carrying Ali Asghar, but it also twisted the body. Ya Allah. Imam Hussein was heartbroken. He looked at the body of Ali Asghar, twisted on that three-pronged arrow. He took the blood that was gushing from it, and he wanted to let it fall on the ground when a cry was heard. The cry said, "Oh Hussein, if this innocent blood is allowed to touch this land, nothing will ever grow here." So my master, with tears in his eyes, flowing like a river, mixed with that innocent blood, looked up at the sky, whereupon another cry was heard. "Oh Hussein, if this blood comes towards the sky, then never will a drop of rain fall from it." Imam Hussein was forlorn. What could he do with this innocent blood? He took the blood and he rubbed it on his beard. Can you imagine? Can you imagine the grief of a father when he has to rub the blood of his six-month-old child onto his own beard? Ya Aba Abdullah. He didn't know how to take the body back to the camp. Can you imagine? The mother is waiting. The mother is anxious. Even the mother will not imagine that the enemy is so cruel they'll kill a child. Ya Allah. He didn't know how to take the body. According to some riwayat, according to many riwayat, the historians inform us that as Imam Hussein approached the tent of Rabah, it was 7 times that he went forward and 7 times he came back in an action. We do it in Amal Ashura tomorrow. And each time as he went, he said, "Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raja'un, ridham bi qada'ihi wa tasleeman li amrih." Verily, we are from Allah and unto Him is our return. We are happy with His will and we carry out His command. Other narrations say that when Imam Hussein finally informed Rabab, they both dug a tiny grave in the desert of Karbala with Imam Hussein's sword, and they buried the six-month-old there. But that wasn't the end of it, my brothers and sisters. That wasn't the end of the dhulm on Ali Asghar. I don't know if you'll be able to bear this, but I'm duty-bound to tell you. As a service to Lady Zahra and Imam Mahdi, following the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, which I have not the strength to go into, Ibn Ziyad announced that anyone who could bring the 7 heads of all of the companions of Hussein would be rewarded. Eventually, all of the heads of the companions were brought. Ibn Ziyad questioned on the head of the six-month-old Ali Asghar, the child that Hormala had killed so brutally. "Oh, my brothers and sisters, can you bear this? This dhulm on the innocents. Oh, my master, Imam Mahdi, we give you condolences." One of the people in Yazid's army explained to him that he saw Hussein burying his son. Therefore, Ibn Ziyad, may Allah curse him, demanded that his army should go around the camp and find that grave, stabbing the ground and find that grave, until they find the grave. One of the soldiers found the body and beheaded Ali Asghar. And his 7 head, along with the heads of the companions and Aba Abdullah, was raised upon the spears. "Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raja'un, ridham bi qada'ihi wa tasleeman li amrih, wa sayya'lamu alladhina zalamu ayyamun qalabiyin qalibun, inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raja'un." Al-Fatiha.